court's ready to hear argument in Warrants v. Kane. You ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Richard Cross of Cross and Simon on behalf of the appellants James H. Warrants Jr. and Ann W. Moffitt. I have requested 5 minutes to reserve 5 minutes for closing.
You understand the clock's going to count down. When you get to your 5 minutes, the yellow light will come on. You're welcome to continue speaking, but you'll be using your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is an appeal from a declaratory judgment action that was filed in the Superior Court involving the restrictive covenants in a neighborhood known as Wickwood, and particularly a lot owned by the appellants, which we refer to as the Warrants property. The case involves restrictive covenants that apply to both the Wickwood neighborhood entirely, as well as restrictions that are contained within the warrants deed. I think I can dispose of one item quickly, and then I want to perhaps go on for a little bit more background. With respect to the restrictions that are contained within the warrants deed, those restrictions say that only one building can be put on the warrants lot, and that restriction is in force as long as the Wickwood restrictive covenants that cover the entire neighborhood are in force. I don't think it is seriously contended that the position of the appellants, which I don't think is seriously challenged, is that if the Wickwood restrictive covenants covering the neighborhood are found to have terminated, the warrants restrictions covering the warrants property then are terminated.
But this whole issue before us today is whether those broader covenants are terminated.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that, in turn, depends upon whether the effort that was made to extend the covenants for a 20-year term rather than the 10-year term that was prescribed in the governing documents invalidated in their entirety. Well, it wasn't valid in its entirety and caused the termination, or simply and validly resulted in a downgrading of the time period from 20 years to 10.
That's correct, and it's the appellant's position that the I think what the trial court called the overreaching attempt to extend it by 20 years was invalid. The trial court found that was invalid as a matter of law. And we don't dispute that contention. That was at least set forth in the preliminary decision by the trial court. It was, again, recited in the final decision, at least in the beginning of it.
But the issue is, what is the effect of that invalidity determination, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. If it's invalid.
The attempt to extend to 20 years was invalid. The question is whether the effect of that invalid attempt it was to invalidate or to terminate the effect of the covenants altogether, or simply to reduce their effective term to 10 years, which had been the practice before.
That's correct. And I think what might be helpful is to take a quick look at the 1944 amendment by which the Wickwood restrictive covenants were amended to provide for a sunset provision that said, beginning in 1970, the restrictions would terminate at the end of, I guess it was the end of December 1970, unless they were renewed. And they could be renewed then for successive 10-year periods.
Is it correct factually that all of the steps for renewal were taken, except that the term of renewal was for 20 years rather than 10? I mean, is that the only variable here?
Well, I think
that's a yes or no.
Your Honor, I guess the answer is no then. And the reason I say no is the language that I was about to quote says that the sunset provision would take effect in December 1970 unless prior to the expiration date an appropriate instrument of writing consenting to the continuation of the restrictions in force for another 10-year period shall be filed. In other words, it's the...
Was there such a document meeting all those criteria except for the 10-year period?
That's correct, but we believe it's the appellant's contention that the express an express term within that document must be that it's for a 10-year period.
I asked whether the only variable was the period, and you said no. Is the answer now yes?
Well, I apologize, Your Honor, if I misunderstood. I thought the court's inquiry was, are all of the requirements met?
Except for the term.
I guess, yes, then the answer is yes. All of the requirements were met. There was a two-thirds requirement. Essentially, the requirements were filed prior to the expiration of the preceding term, a document that is signed by two-thirds of the owners.
The answer is yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So the legal issue is whether the term, the 20-year term that was held invalid, simply results in a substitution of the term that was authorized by the governing document, namely 10 years.
That's
right. Or whether the invalid attempt invalidates in its entirety the extension. Is that right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
What principle the trial court held that the effect of the invalid attempt was simply to reduce the term back to the 10 years that had been provided for theretofore. You say that was an incorrect ruling. And my question is, on what is the principle that governs your position?
Your Honor, in Kane versus Paradise Shores, for example, which we cite in our brief, a court must construe a restrictive covenant to mean only what it actually says, rather than what the draftsman of the covenant, in retrospect, would have liked to have said. In other words, I believe the Kane decision, and I don't believe it's any relation to Ms. Kane, who's a party to this action, the Kane decision stands for the proposition that the court cannot put in terms that the parties would have liked to have said if they had done it right the first time. And that's, in essence, what the appellants contend the trial court did. The trial court...
Well, I'm a little confused now.
Yes, sir.
I thought the trial judge focused on the intent, noted that overwhelming majority, if not unanimously, the people who owned property in that subdivision wanted an extension. They wanted a 20-year extension of the covenant. How do we conclude that their intent to extend for 20 years does not have subsumed within it their intent to extend the covenants for 10 years?
Well, first of all, I don't think there was any factual determination as to what that there was no factual determination by the trial court. Well, let me back up. There were no facts presented to the court that the intent of the homeowners was to extend it for a minimum of 10 and hopefully 20 years. The court...
Well, is that arithmetically logical? If they wanted to extend it for 20, they would, of course, want it extended for 10, or am I confused about math? 20 years is double 10 years. They didn't get that done. How would we logically conclude, as he evidently had difficulty logically concluding, that they would not want it extended for 10 if they wanted it extended for 20?
Well, I can give an example of why I think the court should not conclude that the homeowners at least wanted to extend it for 10. And the problem here, again, is that there were no facts presented to the court concerning the intentions of the homeowners.
Other than the writing of the in the documents,
which purports to extend it for 20 years.
Right.
It does not say that they hope to extend for whatever is legally allowed and hopefully 20. But as an example, the homeowners may not want to have to deal with an issue on a recurring basis, and so they may say, I will agree to extend it for 20 years, or if they come by and say we want to extend it for 100 years, because now I don't have to worry about going back each 10 years and signing this. Perhaps a homeowner would say, if I have to deal with this issue repeatedly, I'm just not going to deal with it at all.
Mr. Cross, let me follow up on Justice Steele's point. It appears that there are three logical possibilities here. The first is that the intent to extend for 20 years, which is undisputed, right, is valid. The second is valid.
To extend for
20. There are three possibilities. One is that the intent to extend for 20 years, which is factually not disputed, is a valid result. The second is that the intent to extend is valid, but the term is 10 years. And the third is that the intent to extend for 20, because it was impermissible, results in no extension at all.
That's correct.
Did I miss anything?
No, Your Honor.
Would you agree with me that the second of the three alternatives is necessarily subsumed within the first? That is, that the parties wanted to extend for 20, it would necessarily follow that they would at least want to extend for 10 if the only other choice was no extension at all.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you that, again, there was no evidence presented.
There may not be a factual record on that, but we're dealing with legal presumptions, aren't we?
Well,
and your presumption, for you to win, you have to persuade us that the presumption or the rule of law would be that if the parties don't express their intent in the way that the court ultimately says was the right way, they lose altogether. That is, they will be treated as if they had no intent to extend at all. Correct?
Well, I think that's correct, except I think it shifts the way that the matter needs to be considered. In other words, first of all, when interpreting when considering a restrictive covenant and whether it is enforceable or what it means, the rule that is similar to the construction of statutes is that no room is left for interpretation or for construction when the language is unambiguous, clear, and specific. And that's a case that the appellees cited as well, Equitable Trust Company.
How does that principle read on these facts? What you're asking us to conclude is that as a matter of law, if the parties don't get it right in terms of their expression, then we have to treat them, we must treat them, as if they had no intent to extend at all. And my question is, does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And here's why. Restrictive covenants are supposed to be interpreted so as to favor the free use of land. And they're supposed to be strictly construed against the grantor. In this case, in order for the trial court to conclude that it was extended for just the 10-year period, the court has to turn that on its head and construe it in favor of the grantor and construe it in favor of keeping a restriction on the property. The other principle I think that's important here is a sort of public policy principle that would that requires the drafter of such a document to be narrow and precise in the manner in which they draft their documents. I cited an out-of-state case because I did not find one in Delaware that stood for this principle. I cited the Pactiv Corp case, and it was in the context of an employment agreement, but it talked about declining to blue pencil a restrictive covenant, saying that a court should consider importantly that the modification could have the potential effect of discouraging the narrow and precise draftsmanship which should be reflected in written agreements.
I understand now the principle that you're relying on, strict construction. And your argument is that not only did the court below not construe the extension of the covenant strictly, but indeed construed it favorably to the grantee. Could it not be argued, however, that by adhering to the 10-year requirement, that the lower court did construe the attempted extension strictly against the grantor?
Well, I think the answer is no, because the case law in Delaware that was cited by the appellants in their briefs, I thought, stood fairly clearly for the proposition that the court cannot rewrite the restrictive covenant in order to have it say what they would like to have had it say. In other words, the court cannot strike the term 20-year extension and write in the term 10-year extension simply as a matter, I guess, as a matter of policy. I think it also leads to somewhat of a can certainly lead to quite a bit of confusion when you're dealing with things like restrictive covenants, in which you now have documents being filed that parties should know anyway are well beyond what they can do, and then assume that apparently homeowners will realize that the restriction is greater than it can be, and they have to go back and fight those things. If the court construes it strictly as the appellants would have the court do, it will simply be struck as it ought to be done, and it will encourage drafters not to be so liberal or overreaching in the way they draft their documents. I'm past my time, unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. John Conley, representing the appellants or appellees, Pamela Kane and Boyd Hopkins. First of all, congratulations, Mr. Chief Justice. I assume this is the first case you've heard after your promotion. I think that the appellant has properly stated most of the facts. The court has hit the highlights of the real question. What the language in this 1970 restriction says, and as far as I'm concerned, unfortunately, when these were rewritten, and there was no factual evidence on this, but the appellants have determined that Pamela Kane, my client, was the drafter. She circulated this document. And the 1970 restriction says that it shall be considered, the restriction shall be considered to be terminated unless prior to the expiration date an appropriate instrument of writing consenting to the continuation shall be extended for another 10-year period. And at the bottom of that paragraph, and likewise thereafter for succeeding 10-year periods. Unfortunately, when the drafter read this, 10-year periods said lots of 10-year periods. It could have been 10, it could have been 20, it could have been 30. So the drafter put in 20 years. Ms. Kane was one of the people who circulated these in previous years, and what has happened over the years that a few people became the circulators of the documents?
Well, be that as it may, the provision that said that there will be a termination unless there is an extension in writing for a period of 10 years was not complied with. The argument is that a strict construction of the covenant, which is the rule that's required under property law, would dictate that that there's a termination because there was no adherence to the literal requirement of the rule.
And that was what I was getting to, Your Honor, because
your position is that there's a different principle that has to apply, isn't it? Namely, that the court has to give effect to the intent of the drafters of the document.
The intent of the drafters, and looking at the words that are used in many of the cases, the words in the cases are free use of land.
Mr. Conley, I'm glad you mentioned cases, because that's the question I have. If we look at Judge Silverman's opinion, starting on page 7, where he gets to this, he didn't cite a single case from Delaware or anywhere else in support of his conclusion. And I've read your brief, and I personally have been unable to identify the leading case that you rely on. So give me the name of the case.
I don't believe there is a case which says that if the drafter has put in 20 years, 10 years would be subsumed within that, as you asked earlier, Your Honor. And I believe that I was unable to find a case which says that. However, the purpose behind the case is to say two things. One,
okay.
Intent.
Okay. Now, you said cases again. Tell me the names of these cases where I can find these purposes.
The cases which talk about intent?
Yeah, give me the name of one and a citation. Because, you know, when we write an opinion, if you win, you'd like us to cite a case, wouldn't you?
Your Honor, Hajoko versus Security Trust, which is a Superior Court case, 25A second, 378, says that the agreements are to be construed liberally to carry out the intention of the parties.
Is that a restrictive covenant case?
That is a a breach of contract case, determining the agreement between a bank and its depositor.
Well, in your answering brief, why didn't you reply to these chancery cases that were cited by your opponent, the one by then Vice Chancellor Jacobs and the one by then Vice Chancellor Berger? You didn't, they're not replied to at all in your brief.
They are not. There is no case law in the opposite direction. I can't cite a case which says something that the court has determined which is opposite of the case that you have quoted.
Yeah, but I look at Kane versus Paradise, where the court, then Vice Chancellor Berger, says we have to construe a restrictive covenant to mean only what it actually says, rather than what the draftsman of the covenant in retrospect would have liked to say. Your opponent says that means if you put in 20 when you should have put in 10, the court can't help you. Then the case by then Justice Jacobs, the Grunewald case, stands for the proposition the court can't rewrite the covenant to inject entirely new substantive provisions to which the grantor never expressed any intent. The argument is you can't put in 20 when you meant 10. But you didn't answer those arguments.
And I will agree with that, Your Honor. It is difficult to quote a case against a case which is Delaware law. There are no Delaware cases which go the other way. And if you're asking me whether there is a case which says that the court can take a restriction and turn it on its head, the only cases which talk about restrictions do not deal with time limits. They deal with the terms of the restriction, whether there's, in this case, one house, one lot, whether the restriction applies to certain lots or not to other lots. But they do not talk about the term of the restriction. And that's the only thing we're talking here, and I think that's a major difference between, as Justice Jacobs has said, it's whether the 10 years is subsumed within the 20 years. What the drafter here says is that it's difficult to get everybody to sign every 10 years, so I put in 20 years because that is a succeeding 10-year period. Multiple 10-year periods.
But as I understand what you're saying is your client looked at this covenant, by example, as if she was going to an ATM machine. And it says, ask for money in multiples of 10. And if you put in a 5, it comes back and it says, no, pick one that's a multiple of 10. And she read this as, if it's multiples of 10, I can pick 20.
Unfortunately, I will tend to agree that that's probably what happened. There was no testimony on that issue, but I have heard from her that she picked 20 because it was a multiple of 10. Now, she could have put in 50, 100, but she didn't do that. And I think that the court, the lower court, in restricting this has said, you know, we looked at what you did. There is a 10-year standard restriction. We are going to reduce this to 10 years because in 10 years, the neighborhood may have changed, number one. Number two, that Mr. Cross's clients or other people who want to change things can come in after 10 years and say to the other neighbors, don't sign this. We don't want to extend this. This does not apply to one lot, which is the one thing which is intriguing about this. This says one house, one lot throughout the entire 20-some lots.
Well, you've confused me a little bit, because I thought what Judge Silverman was saying is, I'm limiting it to 10.
That's correct.
Because that was the only legitimate choice. You picked 20, but it wasn't a choice. It says you can do it for 10. You tried 20. It's not a choice.
That is how I read Judge Silverman's
order. Therefore,
it's
10. But it had nothing to do with what would exist 10 years from now or changes in the neighborhood or anything else, did it?
Your Honor, this is verbiage between the court and counsel when we met with him. This was not written in the order. I will agree with that.
You're saying it's not in the record?
That's correct.
All right. There may be a subtle suggestion here that somewhere in the cases there was a rule that we might call the ATM rule of property law. I haven't found it either.
I would agree with that.
But could it be argued that what Judge Silverman was really doing was strictly construing the covenant and not rewriting the terms? That is, by striking 20 years, he was applying the principle that you can't rewrite the 10-year requirement.
I would not disagree with that, Your Honor. But
the difficulty we have is what the proper application of that principle is or should be, because Judge Silverman dropped back to the 10 years that was specifically allowed by the governing document. Your opponent, Mr. Cross, says no, the only permissible choice under the governing rule would be zero.
Right.
Now, what is your response to that? How are we supposed, in the absence of case law, how are we supposed to apply this principle that you can't rewrite covenants?
We're not asking you to rewrite the covenant. We're asking you to apply the prior covenant and to interpret it, the current covenant, as saying what the prior covenant itself says, the 10-year term. So we're not asking you to change the covenant. We're not asking you to change the terms of the restrictions, who they apply to, how they apply. And in the lower court, something else that was in the lower court's opinion that was interesting, the 1944 restriction, which put the sunset provision in, which was one of the things that I questioned. No one testified, no documentary evidence was shown that 100% of the homeowners in Wickwood approved that 1944 amendment. If we strike the 1944 amendment totally and go back to the original, there was no sunset provision. It would have been a permanent 10-year continuing until terminated, which would have been just the opposite, would have been a permanent restriction renewing itself every 10 years on the 10-year anniversary starting in 1960.
Well, I agree with you that observation is interesting, but unless it bears relevantly on the legal argument, I'm
well,
not sure.
Well, the question is, if the court found that the 1944 restriction was invalid, then we're back to the 1937-36 restriction, which says one house, one lot forever unless you terminate that. And my thought is that 44, which Judge Silverman in the lower court said, so I'm going to find that's valid because everybody lived under it. I'm going to find there was some sort of a waiver. Then we end up with a totally different picture of this entire case. If we eliminate the 44, we're back to the 37 and say, geez, no problem. It is a 10-year restriction, renewable annually on a 10-year basis, not by action of the homeowners, but by action of the restriction itself, which is kind of a turnaround of the whole picture. Now, I don't know that there's a waiver.
I hear you to be saying that maybe there's a fourth choice here that hadn't been considered. Choice number one is 20 years. That was invalidated. Choice number two, which the court below accepted, was 10 years. The appellant argues for zero, that is, no covenant.
That's correct.
You're saying that if there has to be a striking of something, that is, an invalidation altogether of the attempted renewal, then we go back to the original covenant.
That's
but
correct.
Don't you run headlong into the problem of the language of the 1944 amendment, which says that this covenant shall terminate unless...
But that covenant, if that covenant is invalid in 1944, we revert to the 1936-37 original covenant, which says this covenant in 36 or 37 continues until 1960. Thereafter, it is automatically renewed for 10-year periods in perpetuity.
I agree that that's an interesting argument, but was it one raised in your brief?
It was.
On what page?
Was not raised in the argument, it was raised in the statement of facts, page 6.
Would you say that's fully and fairly presented as an argument in your brief?
Probably not, Your Honor. The reason it was not fully and fairly presented in my brief was that it was not relevant unless the court determines that the restriction in 2000 is invalid. At that point, we've got to say, you know, let's take a look back at what they really meant in the year 1944.
And when would this opportunity to consider that argument first arise, other than at the oral argument?
We mentioned it. It was mentioned in a brief to the lower court. It was not mentioned in any of the decisions, except briefly, in which Judge Silverman found that there was a waiver, I think his words.
Maybe you can help me with Judge Silverman's opinion for just a moment. It looks like on page 7 in Roman numeral paragraph 3, he states the law as we all understand it, what we might traditionally call black letter law. And then on page 9, as he applies the undisputed facts to that law, I'm having a little difficulty making the connection. He says that if the covenant's clear, there's no room left for interpretation. But if there's going to be an interpretation, the general rule is you follow the intent of the parties. But if you interpret it consistent with the intent of the parties, and there's some dispute about that, you favor the free use of the land. Those are basically, as I understand it, three guiding principles for
That's
this
correct.
Case. When you get to page 9 and he actually looks at what's going on here, he says, the court concludes as a matter of law that the events that occurred in 2000 amounted to the usual 10-year extension because all the requisites for the traditional 10-year extension existed. Can you put together his conclusion and the principles of law that he stated on page 7 and tell me how he got to where he did?
Your Honor, the free use of land does not mean that that land is used in an unfettered way. That's as I understand it. Therefore, the free use of land is limited in some way. This restriction, which was put on the land, limited that use of land. Therefore, what he was saying is the free use of land, looking at the intent of the parties, was to have one lot, one house for the entire period, including through 2000. And I will agree that the language in his decision was confusing to me the first couple of times I read it. And I understand where he was coming from, I believe, because he was saying these people, these two-thirds of the owners, wanted that restriction. pretty obviously they signed a document saying they wanted the restriction. Therefore, the court will look at their intentions. Their free use of land is so that other people do not build additional houses on these lots within this development, do not subdivide the development itself, any of the lots, not just the lot that the plaintiffs are arguing about or the appellants, but any lot within a development. They don't want to expand this. And I think that's where he was coming from. That's the way I'm reading it.
Well, one thing that surprised me in the record is, to the extent the judge talked about waiver by compliance with regard to what was going on in 1944, this lot, as it's subdivided, was part of the development, and then part of it was outside of the development. And when it was reconfigured to be two buildable lots, you had to get a minor subdivision plan approved. And no one's talking about the fact that the minor subdivision plan was approved, apparently, without objection. So, most minor subdivision plans for approval, you have to notify neighbors within so many feet. And it would seem that if these people were really concerned about this area resulting in two buildable lots, someone would have opposed the minor subdivision plan. But it really is somewhat anomalous to have a minor subdivision plan approved and then to have the neighbors come in and say, well, you can't build on it anyway.
The neighbors are only saying that you can't build on the part that is in Wickwood. The other portion, theoretically, you can build on, Your Honor.
But was it ever addressed in the record that the minor subdivision, was the relevance of the approval of the minor subdivision plan ever considered?
It was not, Your Honor. And I've just about run out of time, and I'm going to ask the court to affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Very briefly, I thought one issue that is important that is getting thrown around is the idea that interpretation of the covenants in order to give effect to the intent of the parties. And I think the case law suggests that you don't get to the point of interpreting the restriction and looking at the intent of the parties if the language of the covenant is unambiguous, clear, and specific. And for that proposition, I look at the Equitable Trust Company case, a case cited by the appellees. The court said, where the language of a covenant is unambiguous, clear, and specific, paraphrasing, no room is left either for interpretation or for construction. Otherwise, however, the paramount rule for the interpretation of covenants is so to expound them as to give effect to the actual intent of the parties. And I think there's other case law as well that suggests the same result.
Isn't that what Judge Silverman concluded? If you get to the heart of his application of the undisputed facts on page 9 to his statement on page 7, he's saying it's clear that the parties to this covenant intended that it be extended. They extended it farther than they had the authority to extend it, but there can't be any genuine dispute that their intent was to extend the covenant. So he took the position that they had done everything that was necessary to extend it for the 10-year period. They were simply wrong when they tried to extend it for 20 because they were without the authority to do so. So isn't he saying there isn't any genuine dispute here about what their intent was, and I'm simply putting into effect what is clear to me to be the intent of the parties?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say, and I guess I'm not being very clear about it, is I think the trial court leapfrogged over an initial hurdle. The initial hurdle is you have to find that the language in the restriction was not clear and unambiguous. In this case,
he said it was clear and unambiguous, but as Justice Steele is asking, he's basically saying it's clear. You could do it for 10 years. You wanted to do it for 20, and I'm ruling as a matter of law it's only extended for 10, and notwithstanding the fact that it says 20, it's unenforceable after 10. Isn't that really what Judge Silverman said?
It is what he said, but I guess what I am trying to say is that when you take the various propositions that are set forth in the case law, including the Kane decision and the Equitable Trust decision, the court cannot construe it to say something that they that the parties would have liked to have said. And when the language starts out itself is clear, the court should not then try to determine some intent that's not set forth within the document. The document itself is clear.
Well, we're back to where we started in my mind anyway. Tell me why someone who says, I want to use this car for 20 years, and you tell them you can only use it for 10, is going to say, I don't want any car at all.
And I'm over my time, but I'll answer the question. It's because when you look at the principles that surround interpretation of restrictive covenants, they have to be construed against the grantor and in favor of the free use. And as I said in the beginning, I think it's been turned on its head in that it's being construed to restrict the use and against and in favor of the grantor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also take a brief recess.
Please rise.